From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On this Veterans Day, former NPR host and war correspondent Neil Conan joins Forum to talk about his ongoing theatrical collaboration with musicians and artists honoring U.S. military veterans.
The stories of these men and women that we're telling, it's really moving to me because so often in our business, we follow their stories when they're going and when they get hurt. But a lot of the time, we leave it there, and this really addresses what happens after that.
We'll talk to the former Talk of the Nation host about that show called Between War and Here, and about his podcast, Truth, Politics, and Power, which looks at the state of U.S. democratic institutions in the Trump era. That's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're marking Veterans Day today with Neil Conan, longtime host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's currently touring with a musical group, Ensemble Galilee, as part of a collaboration honoring U.S. military veterans wounded in war. The work, which was performed in Berkeley last night, features the poetry of Carolyn Surik and was inspired by her experiences performing for patients at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. We're going to talk with Neil Conan about that and his other projects, including the new podcast, The Democracy Test, which looks at the state of our institutions during the Trump era. So good to have you here, Neil
Michael,
Conan.
It's good to see you again. Nice to be back on the radio with you.
Glad to have you back. And you're back in action here in so many things and doing so many things and living part-time in Hawaii and part-time in Montana, and we'll catch up with you. But first, I want to talk about veterans with you because this is an exciting project, and I think our listeners will want to know what you're talking about. And you're talking a lot about vets and what they go through and what they – in fact, we had T.J. Chivers on recently, and he was saying the hardest part – for many of us, it's not necessarily going to war, but when we come home.
Exactly, yeah. And particularly if you're coming home without part of your leg or part of your arm. Or these are stories about people who were blown up in Afghanistan or in Iraq and coming to Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital. And this was set in a place there called Malone House, where they could visit with their families. It's sort of like a very nice hotel, except everybody there is, you know, going to therapy or prosthetics or surgery. And so the resilience and courage of these men and women is extraordinary. You feel what you want about the politics of what they were involved in, but these people went willingly and made sacrifices for you and me. And this is a day we should all be remembering them and their sacrifices. And it's been an honor to be part of this project. Is also my old friend and colleague, I'm sure you know, Ann Garrels, is part of the project as well.
And both of you had a good deal of experience with war.
In fact, many people
may remember that you were actually taken by the Iraqi Republican Guard.
Well, they spit me back out. But Annie spent 7 years in Baghdad for NPR, and you know, before that, Chechnya, and before that in Bosnia. So she certainly has a lot of experience covering war more than I did. I was I started on Talk of the Nation on September 10th, 2001. That was a Monday, and the next day the world changed. So I was on the air for much of that.
And people are going to ask, so we'll come back to the projects you're involved in, but you fought against Talk of the Nation going off the war, and it was a big loss to so many people. Can you at least speak to that just for the moment?
Oh, it was a big loss for me, too. It was... NPR was in a difficult financial position. They were serious people with serious financial problems. I did not understand why they decided to take Talk of the Nation off the air, or for that matter, Tell Me More. These were not programs that made money, but they did not lose money, and they served a purpose. But something had to be done, and I was furious, to put a word in, but... And the situation, the financial situation, resolved itself shortly after the deed was done. And so it was all pointless. But anyway.
Well, what certainly isn't pointless is the attention that you are giving to vets and to people who have suffered in war. And also the word hope keeps coming up here.
Oh, absolutely. The word hope and the word alarm, too. But hope in the sense that these are amazing people, and you look at the way they respond to the challenges in their lives, and it does nothing but give you hope that, first, humanity in general and these people in particular are going to lead us to a better place. And I think we saw this past election so many more veterans, not just of military service, but of the Central Intelligence Agency and other places, running for office. And I think that's going to change our culture. We have been so long where no one in Congress had represented themselves, had served in the military, maybe John McCain, Lindsey Graham as a lawyer, a few others. But the percentage was very, very low, certainly compared to the post-World War II years, post-Korea years, even the post-Vietnam years.
So talk about this collaboration, you and Angelos, but also this group Galilei, which I think is named for the father of Galileo.
Indeed, who's one of the creators of modern music. He was first to, among the first to say, you know, hey, maybe we should get a group together and put on a show.
Which is what you did.
Yeah, turned out to be opera in his case, but we're rather less ambitious. It is a wonderful group. I've been performing with them for many years, going back to, a Christmas show 10, 12 years ago in Annapolis. But we did a show based on the Hubble Space Telescope pictures that was called Universe of Dreams. And then we worked with the National Geographic on First Person to the Edge of the World, and then with the Metropolitan Museum in New York on First Person Seeing America. So we've done a bunch of different shows together, and the process is amazing. This show, we came in with the text. It was Carolyn Zurek's book of poetry, Between War and Here. So we were only arguing about the music rather than the text.
Well, music is mainly chamber music, isn't it?
No, it's Irish music.
It's got some Irish Celtic music, too.
It's Celtic music, yeah. And the members of the group also compose their own music and Renaissance music as well, yeah.
And there's, like, the opening for us in this show, the opening...
Yes, that's a number...
It goes back to Scottish music.
It does. It was written after what the English call the Battle of Culloden. And, of course, history is written by the victors, as we hear. The best music is written by the other side, in this case, the Scottish side. That was the last land battle in what is now Britain.
About those who died in battle. We're talking early 16th century.
The slaughter of the Scottish aristocracy and middle class, yes, at the Battle of Culloden.
So this was performed at Freight and Salvage just last night.
Just last night, yes. Yeah, it was a wonderful audience, and we had a great performance, and it was really a lot of fun.
So you're having fun with that, and you're also having fun raising macadamia nuts. it's a big haul of macadamia nuts, isn't it?
We have 5.5 acres, so it's not a major farm. But our best year has been 26,000 pounds of macadamia
nuts. That's a lot of macadamia nuts.
It is, yeah.
And you're living near this dead volcano? You hope it's dead.
Extinct is the best kind of volcano, but there are 5 volcanoes on our island, 2 of which are active, but they're luckily far away from me.
And then there's the podcast.
Yes. After the election, it was predictable that we were going to have a lot of serious problems with electing somebody who's clearly unqualified for the office in many respects. And so we started a podcast called Truth, Politics, and Power, and we were lucky enough to be here on KQED right from the start. And that lasted for weekly hour for about a year. And we've decided to make it instead what our friends at American Public Media call a pop-up. They like to call it the Netflix model. They say stations are much more interested in specials that they can promote. So we just finished, wrapped up a series called The Democracy Test from Truth, Politics, and Power, which we co-hosted with Heather Cox Richardson, who's a historian at Boston College. And you may remember her also from the podcast Freak Out and Carry On, which I wish I'd come up with that title.
There's a lot in these podcasts about trust in government. In fact, there's a lot about the erosion of trust. And let's talk about that for the moment, because you talked about an unqualified chief executive. It's also a chief executive who, according to the Washington Post, at least lies or misrepresents the truth about 35 times a day.
If his lips are moving, yes.
If his lips are moving, exactly. And so, I mean, there was enough of a lack of trust under Nixon. This is exponential to that.
It is. And we were talking with a wonderful woman, Sophia, and I'm blanking on her last name. She grew up in the same town I grew up in. She went to the same school my sisters did. It was interesting. I was talking to her about that. I assume Leslie Gore is still the most famous alumna of the Dwight School. She said, no, in my time it was Britney Spears. So anyway. She talks a lot about how the character of the lies changed. I mean, you know, of course, Trump is an inveterate liar from his days as a real estate developer in New York and from his days as a civilian, if you were. But she says he sent out his press secretary on the first day, on his inauguration day, to lie about the size of the crowd on the mall, the nature of his lies changed in that he was having other people lie for him, and then forcing those who support him to support his lies. And that's when it changes just from being, you know, lies to being, you know, something you really need to worry about in terms of this is how you develop autocracy. This is how you develop a cult of personality.
And you actually did a segment on the I word, on impeachment.
Yeah, yeah. That was before on Truth, Politics, and Power. And it is impeachment that was, you know, it's almost to talk about it now before the Mueller report comes out in whatever form it comes out seems to be, you know, wildly premature at best. Yes, Democrats will control the House of Representatives. And yes, I think if they held a party line vote, they could impeach Donald Trump today. But it's got to go to the United States Senate for a trial where you need the votes of 67 United States senators.
Nancy Pelosi has been, you know, very reluctant to even bring it up. But then Tom Steyer long ago
has been running ads on this.
And the way the news goes these days, it was long ago, was really putting a lot of money behind it.
Yes, indeed. Well, because of the outrage. I mean, you can understand the outrage. You can understand people's feelings that impeachable offenses have been committed. But do the math. You know, you get 20 Republicans in the United States Senate to vote along with the Democrats? I don't think so.
Talking with Neal Conan, and he is, of course, public radio journalist and co-host now of the podcast Truth, Politics, and Power, distributed by American Public Media. You can hear it here on KQED, and you can also, can people avail themselves of Ensemble online, obviously?
Oh, yes. Go to EnsembleGalilei.com, and you can find out. And there's the music for this most recent show is collected on a CD called The Flowers of the Field. Flowers of the Forest,
Flowers of the Forest, yeah.
Or you can go to truthpoliticsandpower.org and avail yourself of any of our episodes, previous episodes.
And the poetry and music is well worth availing yourself of. And there's also a lot of thought that went into this, a lot of careful preparation to make people realize, especially on a day like today, the sacrifices, as you said.
And indeed, but it's also important to remember, many of us don't know anybody who serves in the United States military. It's not like World War II or Korea or Vietnam. It is a very small fraction of the American population that is now in Iraq or Afghanistan and now occupying something north of a quarter of the country of Syria, which we tend to forget. This is an area about the size of Indiana, all of Syria, east of the Euphrates River. And, well, this is going to have consequences.
When I had Chivers on, we were talking about the fact that one of the epigraphs to his book is the Marines are fighting the war, America's at the mall.
Right.
And the reality is that he kind of was a little bit wary about broaching this topic, but he said maybe we should think about bringing conscription back because it would make Americans more involved as opposed to this volunteer army that is just to remove from our everyday lives.
I don't want to be a hypocrite. I am of the age where I spent a while avoiding the draft. Nevertheless, at this age when I'm no longer subject, national service at least seems something that ought to be reconsidered, in part because you meet people from other parts of the country, from other walks of life. You are engaged with them in a way that, well, we were doing this program about, partly we were talking about Robert Dalek, about his new biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was talking about the CCC and the other programs where men and most, it was almost entirely men in those days, from different parts of the country met to work on all these projects together. And it changed their relationship. It forged them as a nation. And again, that experience was then, of course, redoubled and quadrupled and octupled in the Second World War, where so many people were called to service. And I think that changed the character of the nation because so many people knew each other. You weren't, you know, people from California or people from Maine weren't strangers because you were working with them or serving with them.
We also just did a show on civics and the importance of civics education, and a lot of that is echoing what you're saying about the necessity of having people working together, doing a democracy, essentially, mm-hmm. and following the democracy. It used to be implicit in so many things that it isn't anymore.
Indeed, and all the community service that used to be much more important than it is today, and I think that has to be revived too. All the people we talked to, Mr. Appiah, the philosopher from Princeton and now the ethicist from the New York Times, he's at NYU now, I think. But anyway, he was talking about how we need to work on programs together, and it's not you know, strictly politics. It's the PTA. It's, you know, the soccer team. It's the, you know, work with people from, you know, various walks of life and get to know your community. And in ways that we're well, so isolated these days, you know, I'm stuck on our macadamia nut farms in Hawaii and don't get out enough.
There's another point, though, that came up in the Chivers interview, and that was the disconnect, another big disconnect between mm-hmm. those who make policy, the generals, the people in the Pentagon, and the soldiers who are fighting the wars.
I think there's a big divide between the enlisted and the officers. I think there's a big cultural divide. I think there's relatively few of the officers come from the ranks and from officers training, and more of them come from professional schools. Now, that it's interesting, it develops into a political divide where I think the rank and file tend to be Trump supporters that vote Republican. Most of the officers go the other way.
Well, at the risk of our sounding like we're bashing our leader, you want to talk about President Trump's failure to attend the events in France marking the armistice, or for that matter, the White House has confirmed today that the president will not visit Arlington Cemetery?
It must be raining.
Well, he could have somebody hold an umbrella over his head. He did that on a couple of occasions. Right?
It's indefensible. It is utterly indefensible. The president of the United States is not merely the head of government. The president of the United States is the head of state. You know, we tend to think of the Prime Minister of Britain and the Queen. The Queen is the head of state. She is the one who presides over those secular ceremonies at the Cenotaph in London, where they mark the 11th day, the 11th hour, the 11th month of 1918, where the guns fell silent on the Western Front. She is the one who, the head of state has obligations to the nation. And as horribly as Donald Trump has performed as the head of government, he has been an utter and complete disgrace as the head of state.
Would you be expressing this if you were still a talk of the nation?
Absolutely. I might be in trouble, but I would be expressing it.
And since you said you avoided or fought against serving during Vietnam, mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that. I was on a National Defense Fellowship, and so the government and LBJ were paying for my education, and I was not conscripted. But otherwise, I might be living in Canada. What about bone spurs for somebody who's a commander-in-chief?
Yeah, well, somebody said the drizzle is the new bone spurs.
I like that. Can you say the source? Can you source it?
I forget. It was somebody on Twitter.
We're talking to Neil Conan.
I wish I'd come up with it.
Well, let me ask listeners to come up with any questions you might have for Neil Conan. We're covering a lot of territory here. And some thoughts maybe you might want to reflect on Veterans Day, and you may indeed want to just simply join this conversation. I haven't asked Neil yet. Are you driving yet, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Ah.
I can see personal triumphs.
And that was brought to fruition when?
Well, because we live in remote areas in both Hawaii and we spend part of the year in Montana as well. And you're going to get to the grocery store, you better learn how to drive.
And when
on
you
the
say
other hand,
we,
you have to go back to my wife and I.
Greta Ehrlich, who
Greta
many
Ehrlich,
people
yes.
may know of. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And
so you need to drive.
I need to drive, yes. And she would not put up with me. So.
Well, let me invite listeners to join us. I know there are many fans of Neil's regular listeners to Talk of the Nation. They may be even as outraged as he continues to be about it being taken off the air. But you may want to talk about veterans on Veterans Day and the hope that we have invested and that certainly has come up here, as well as what we also touched on, the erosion of trust and impeachment. We've really covered a pretty broad swath here, and you may want to add your voice. And if you do, let me tell you how you can join us. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Please feel free to join us now at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways you can be part of this program, and again, we invite you to do that. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is the boilerplate stuff that you remember and maybe
I was just thinking, there are certain phone numbers you will never forget. You know, your first number that you memorized when you were a kid. The radio station where you first did a fundraising drive, and of course the phone number that Oxford 7-2288. That was the
number. My number in Cleveland was the same thing, frontward and backwards.
Really?
932-6239. Yeah,
uh-huh.
It was kind of distinctive.
That is, yeah.
Sui generis. I'm going to ask you also. We're going to our caller shortly, but I remember once we were talking about this whole life that we've had as hosts of mm-hmm. programs and so forth, and I was. I would credit it to a certain kind of semi-lunacy. I was reading sometimes 3-4 books a day, I mean a week.
I had to make a rule, no more than 2 a week.
You did make that 2 to me, and it really had a lot of impact on me at the time. And I thought, this is crazy, I'm burning too much midnight oil. And,
exactly. You know, right? And then you're dead by Thursday.
But there was also something else that came up in a conversation we had a while back, and that is the respect you show for someone you have on the air by being familiar with their work and by, if they've written a book, actually reading their book.
Actually reading the, yeah, absolutely. Because there are hosts, they shall go unnamed, who have their staff read the book and write a précis. I find this to be reprehensible because, again, it is basic respect. The process of writing a book and reading a book is to get into the author's mind and to find out what they're on about, to, you know, and you don't get that from a précis. You just don't. So you have to make the effort. I think Terry Gross once said, the eye must fall on every page, which is not quite the same as a careful reading. But you have to do your very best. And, you know, that's basic. And as some people say, you know, do you miss the show? And I say, oh, yeah, I miss the show.
But
I don't,
not the preparation.
I don't miss getting ready for the show, no.
I remember you said that to me, and I could understand that, well understand that. But there's something about
there will
absorbing
be
all of this and trying to be on top of the news and so forth that's challenging on a day-to-day basis. You still don't miss the preparation. Though.
I don't. It's interesting. When we've been doing the podcast, when it was on an hour a week for a year, you know, that was a tremendous amount of work, so you had to be up, and a lot of it was done in Hawaii, so you end up living on East Coast time in Hawaii, and, you know, God help you if you're interviewing somebody from Europe, so in the middle of the night to get up and do that interview. And the other part of it is I preferred the production schedule when we were just doing 6 of them, but again, ending up for a month and a half on East Coast time, it was pretty interesting work.
I think you once compared doing radio to making music.
I did?
Well, I think so. When you were talking about Galilee and this ensemble you have, there are analogies there, aren't there? Maybe you didn't say it, but I thought I recalled you saying it. But nevertheless, I was thinking about putting together a program like the one you did last night.
Assembling a program like the one we did last night in radio. Yeah, there are a lot of analogies to that. And they're interesting in the performance part of it, at least from my point of view. There are a lot of analogies to hitting the posts, you know, when the music comes up in your ears and you realize you have, what, 20 seconds left? And this is Ensemble Galilee.
We're hearing it as you're speaking here, Neil Conan, our guest. And if you want to join us, please feel free to do that. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. He is co-host of the podcast Truth, Politics, and Power, distributed by American Public Media. And we're also talking about veterans because he has put together, along with a number of people, including an ensemble, this amazing program that many people had the joy of seeing and the thought-provoking experience of seeing last night at Freight and Salvage. We'll continue and we'll take your calls and emails. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Neil Conan, now driving automobiles, but still a Luddite, I believe. calls himself a Luddite. And there's so many things that we could talk about, Neil. I mean, we mentioned, for example, you're being held during the Iraq War with Chris Hedges, and doing a book on play-by-play in baseball for a small team in the minors. But let me get back to Trump for a moment before we go to our callers, because there is a sense, and one hears it a good deal, that I'll use an example of what, because we're going to go to our listeners and our callers. We were having a discussion last week, and someone sent in an email and said, this is what I call a slow Saturday night massacre. Mm-hmm. And with Whitaker, maybe as well bring it newsworthy for the moment, with Matt Whitaker.
The acting attorney general.
The acting attorney general, who is clearly a Trump loyalist. Trump at first said he didn't know him, and then that he did know him, then he said he didn't know him. And so we have that typical kind of attenuating the truth. Is there a nice way to put it?
No, there isn't.
Lying. All right. But what do you make out of it now, I mean, at this point, with respect to what's happening?
Well, it will be interesting, at the very least, to see what happens in the next couple of months, because one of the programs we did on the democracy test was one of the episodes was checks and balances. Well, we're about to have some checks and balances because the Democrats are about to take over the House of Representatives, and I think that's going to serve as a interesting break.
A lot of subpoenas, but maybe subpoenas will lead to, because he's already given that warning, his using the Senate where he has a majority and using it to find out where leaks are and who is, you know, violating the law in the Senate.
Like I say, it's going to be interesting. But the next couple of months, while he still has majorities in the House and the Senate, is he going to try to rein in the Mueller investigation, I guess is the big question, or, you know, get rid of it in some form? And that would seem to be inviting some sort of impeachment investigation afterwards. But, you know, again, the point of that seems to elude me at this juncture. But it is, has he brought him in to crush Mueller? And if so, we will find out. And it was kind of interesting. One of the, again, on the checks and balances episode of the democracy test, we were talking about, you know, yes, the courts played their role in Watergate. Congress, you know, Sam Ervin certainly played a role in Watergate. And clearly the press played a role in Watergate. But one of the key places of resistance was the federal bureaucracy and Mark Felt and the FBI, who were deeply offended by Richard Nixon for reasons that many of us weren't necessarily offended by Richard Nixon, but in terms of his trampling on what they saw as the FBI's independence. And so there are going to be sources of resistance that will surprise us. And clearly, you know, Mark Felt found the need to work through another institution, the media. Through Bob Woodward.
Well, somebody already published, we don't know who that person was, that article in the New York Times, that editorial.
The anonymous editorial about sweeping papers off.
But that's
the
an excellent point about maybe something coming from justice, which has been undermined and so forth. But also, I'm just wondering, I mean, we're just guessing because the Mueller investigation is pretty tightly sealed, like a drum.
But there, waiting until the election, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the buzz is now that maybe the report is going to come out soon. I'm wondering if there are any sealed indictments, particularly coming out of New York State as well.
That will be also interesting because those are investigations the president of the United States cannot control. And so it's not going to be just New York, but it is going to be clearly California and other places. But New York, as the site of if Russian oligarchs were laundering money through Trump properties, that's where we're going to find out about that. And that were, if that was done and if it is indictable, it's a crime that happened before he was president of the United States.
And Whitaker said that's really off limits in effect, which is why he can realize that he was probably hand-selected. I'm just wondering also what
But he doesn't control the attorney general of the state of New York.
Oh, that's right, exactly. Wondering what you think about what you're talking about the press, the enemy of the people. The White House revoked.
Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, for being the enemy of the people. The press credentials of CNN's Jim Acosta, and this is pretty tricky for media organizations to handle. I mean, how should they? Can you talk about this and maybe even talk about how news outlets, including NPR, should or should not adapt to deal with the war on the media by the president?
By the president of the United States, it's a dilemma. You honestly don't know how to deal with it. Do you boycott the White House? wait a minute. Boycott the White House? Isn't your job to be there to do the reporting, to learn what you can on behalf of, you know, your listeners? I honestly don't know. You know, I served for a while as news director at National Public Radio, and I don't know how I would have responded to this. I would have had to sit down and talk to people and try to figure out how they felt, and particularly the White House correspondents, and see how it's. But our job is to cover things. Our job is not to walk out on things, and to be there in times of crisis, which obviously we're in now. But the crisis also involves us. So how do you respond? Isn't it? It's a true dilemma. I don't know.
Is it even more of a true dilemma when you report something, you report it accurately, and it's called fake news?
And it's called fake news. And you were called a terrible person and incredibly rude.
Let's go to our callers. We begin, Sue, with you from Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. So nice to hear Neil on the radio again.
Oh, thank you, Sue.
I was wondering, as I was hearing the results of the election, that it seemed to me that the Democrats rightly honed in on the House, where you see the focus is so different on health care, things that affect people every day, where the Senate seems more like the more elite body, And it just seemed to make sense to me that the Democrats really honed in on where they needed to be at the grassroots. What do you think?
I think they honed in where they actually could. The Senate map this year was so difficult for Democrats. 34, 35 seats were up, and they were defending 25 of them, including 10 in states that Trump had won by double digits. So you know, that made the Senate map truly difficult and, as we've learned, not doable. The House was doable, but I think even more important than that are the state legislatures. Those elections will, in 2 years' time, those are the people who will be redrawing the maps for the next decade. Those are the vital elections.
Or Democrats, some cynics would say they would be in charge of gerrymandering.
Well, it's, yes, gerrymandering. But it's interesting. There are several states that passed resolutions, budget ballot proposals to have independent agencies redraw the maps in their states. But yes, who redraws those maps? But if you look at places like North Carolina or Ohio, where Democrats won the majority of the seats, majority of the votes for the House of Representatives in the state of Ohio, and come away with a third of the seats in Congress, those sorts of things need to be reversed. That's a real threat to our democracy. It's one of the things we did in the democracy test.
Yeah, and when we're talking about trust and democracy, I mean, you look at what's going on in Florida now, and Georgia, and vote suppression in Georgia, probably.
Indeed.
And so forth. I mean. And the administration, even when Trump was campaigning, he was talking about election is going to be rigged. And, you know, what does this do for people's faith in the democratic process?
It corrodes it. It is seemingly Donald Trump's, passion to corrode faith in our institutions. And this passion he shares with Vladimir Putin, that democracy is seen as the greatest threat to autocrats around the world. And we're seeing threats to it in places, not just in the United States, of course. We saw this in the Brexit vote. We saw this in Poland, in Hungary, in Marine Le Pen.
We see it in the Philippines. We see it in Turkey. I mean, it's just
absolutely
ubiquitous.
And it is it's the institutions that were established by the United States with others after the Second World War to try to rein in the forces that caused two disastrous wars in the 20th century. Those institutions are being undermined even as we speak. And we're getting back. Well, Robert Kagan, I'm sure you've read his book.
We've had him on the program.
Return to the Jungle. And we're talking about great power. And what happens is when you have great power, people looking out for themselves. Didn't you love what Emmanuel Macron had to say over the weekend about nationalism as he was speaking to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in front of him? There's a man showing some guts.
Well, you know, since I mentioned Acosta, I was also struck by, I don't know how many people picked up on this, when Trump was calling him all those names and everything else, he says, I am responsible for running this country. You run CNN, try to bring up their ratings. Now, first of all, Jim Acosta doesn't run CNN.
No.
But also, and Donald Trump doesn't run the country, but maybe in Donald Trump's mind, he does run the country.
He does run the country. It's our country. Yeah, it's my country. Yeah. It's all about me.
You criticize me, you criticize the country.
Yeah.
More calls. Marty, you're on the air. Hi, Marty.
Good morning. It's a question and a statement. How are the evangelicals addressed as to the morality and the ethics of Donald Trump? Trump says that the news media is constantly lying about him, and then he turns around and does it so many times nationwide. And the evangelicals really follow him and believe him. I have family members that just love Trump, and I think, my God, how do you do this? And how do we look at the people in the Midwest who believe in almost the violence of campaigning and the violence of treating each other? I thought it would have died by now. I'm 77 years old. And I think, how are we going to get out of this dilemma?
A couple of big questions, Neil.
Indeed. First of all, in terms of the Midwest, if you look at the election results in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and places like that, I'm not sure we can characterize this as a Midwest phenomenon. Yes, those were the places that Donald Trump won and were critical to his election. But that's begun to turn around. In terms of evangelicals, you have to think of people who I'm hardly an expert on evangelicals, but in terms of what I've read, people who feel that they are threatened in such a way that it justifies their support for someone that they find, I have to assume that they find odious in some way.
They also, though, I mean, in fact, NPR did a special talking to evangelical women in the Deep South and so forth, and they do really revere Trump, and they see him as a man who's going to stop all these babies from being killed.
Yes.
I mean, that's a big issue, obviously, but also someone who indeed has become an instrument of their Lord and God.
Yes, and I find
despite,
that terrifying.
You know, what's going on with paying off porn stars and all the rest of
it. Indeed, and all of the scandals and as they continue to mount.
And we'll get some more callers on. And let's get back to vets, I think, with Leslie's talking about soldiers. Go ahead, Leslie. You're on.
Well, hi. Good morning. It's a thrill to be on with you, Neil. I think you're fantastic and a wonderful, intelligent voice. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have a quick comment about I canvassed for Josh Harder in Modesto. I'm from the Bay Area. And they were receiving, many voters were receiving letters that said it was from voter power or something. And they were mischaracterizing the years that the person in the household had voted. And they were all wrong. And I talked to one man who says, oh, you know, the Democrats can't, you know, the state can't even keep this straight.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be a fake letter. And it was to kind of raise that question of, you know, is your vote really being counted?
Yeah, and does it matter at all?
Exactly. That was in California.
Yeah, and I think this is an aspect of, I don't know if you saw the film Dark Money.
In fact, we had the filmmakers on.
Yeah, we had her on one of our segments as well. But I think this is an aspect of dark money. These are people sending out, these are campaigns funded by outside organizations that are sending out these letters for various purposes. Most of them are electoral, but some are not. And I think this is an example of that.
And good to hear from you, Leslie. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the compliment.
Another caller joins us. That's Peter. Peter, you're on.
Yeah, good morning. Fascinating conversation. Thank you. I just would like to draw people's attention to the writings of Siegfried Sassoon, the English writer who was very badly wounded in the First World War, went back to England and was convalescing. And he made the comments then that are basically being repeated now. Very, very difficult for vets to relate to their families back home and their friends because they have absolutely no concept of what they went through. And it causes a tremendous dislocation in relationships. And, on this very somber day, as we remember 1918, I'm just reminded that we do not seem to have learned anything in the last 100 years. And I just wondered if you guys were familiar with Siegfried Sassoon and his writings.
Peter, I am. In fact, I've taught Siegfried Sassoon in my other life as a literature professor and value his work a great deal. He went in, like so many of those World War One soldiers from Britain, from all over, with a great sense of nationalism and idealism and was wounded and came out terribly disillusioned. And that's often the trajectory.
You know? Kipling is another example after his son was killed. There's a passage in one of Carolyn's poems. I'm not going to she's not Siegfried Sassoon, but it
is. Who also wrote a book called Memoir of a Fox-Hunting Man.
But
he was an aristocrat, basically.
But the veterans facing questions from old friends who can't understand what guns do, what war smells like, feels like, tastes like, is. And that's, I'm paraphrasing, she said it better than that. But I think that's the same aspect of the questions you're getting to. And it is one thing to have had that experience where so many could not understand it, civilians couldn't understand it, after the First World War, when such a huge percentage of the manhood of England went to war, Britain went to war, and Ireland too. But now, when such a tiny fraction of the population is involved in combat on behalf of the country, it's another thing entirely because there are so few people who really do get it.
I'm reading, in fact, this is a promo for later this week. Daniel Mason, novelist and psychiatrist, has a new novel out, and it's placed in World War One, and it's very compelling because you realize that soldiers did have all over this kind of idealism, but through every war, really, especially one might say World War Two, which was, but World War One was the war to end all wars.
Yeah.
Also, I was going to mention Daniel Mason, excuse me, because he writes about PTSD, but they called it shell-shocked at the time.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you were going to say?
Well, it's also, you know, the phenomenon of nationalism arose after the war to end all wars, and it ended up tearing the world apart.
It's also, Hemingway comes to mind. There's a story of Hemingway's called Soldier's Home, where, the soldier returns, a soldier named Krebs, to his home in Kansas, and it's very difficult for him. He has what amounts to PTSD, and they didn't have that name for it then.
Combat fatigue.
Yeah, or shell-shocked. Here's a listener who writes, I honor veterans by supporting causes and institutions that help them. I feel a great need to do so because my father was a veteran, and he paid the rest of his life for his service with an interrupted education and PTSD. I also honor them by not mouthing pious platitudes about them and their service. My father lived just long enough to loathe the term greatest generation, and had he lived longer, would have died of laughter to hear everyone in uniform labeled a hero. He thought that one of the worst consequences of our low military service rate was too many people having far too high an opinion of the military.
Well, it is interesting as you look at the institutions that the American people, you know, trust and believe in, and clearly the media has fallen down. Congress is even lower. The one institution that people do have a lot of trust in is the military, and you can make of that what you will.
Another comment from Kathy, who says, I can second the idea your guest mentioned about national service, bringing people together who might otherwise never come together. My great uncle stationed in Siberia in 1918 learned a great deal about the Chinese and the Russians he came in contact with, as well as men from very different backgrounds.
A campaign that is often forgotten, where U.S. troops were involved in Siberia at the end of the First World War.
Yes, indeed. There's a comment that, getting back to impeachment, that Warren brings up. Wonder what your response is, Neil. He says, during the Nixon administration, many, including the president, thought the Senate would protect him until the House started impeachment proceedings, causing support, including Republicans, to dissipate on a daily basis. Wouldn't we expect to experience something similar if serious charges on Trump from the Mueller investigation were put forth in the House?
I would disagree with the presumption in that. It was not the House proceedings that caused Republican support to fade. It was the smoking gun of the Watergate tapes, where the president is on tape admitting to federal crimes, and that's what caused support to dissipate amongst the Republicans. Yes, it was a delegation of Republicans led by Barry Goldwater, among others, who went to the White House and said, Mr. President, you are going to be impeached, and if you are impeached, you're going to be convicted. And that's what caused him to make the decision to resign. Yes, Republicans now, too, control that process. I don't see that sort of independence and that sort of judgment, nor do I see that sort of evidence, frankly, as yet, that would force people to make that judgment. So I think we're early in the process still.
There's always this analogy to where are the Howard Bakers, you often hear, during Watergate, who was a Republican.
What did the president know and when did he know it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think you have Republicans who would be willing at this point to move in that direction who are in the Senate and, for that matter, in the House. But the House, look at the history. I mean, the impeachments we've seen, I know you even covered in your broadcast,
sure,
Andrew Johnson.
So
you had the biographer of Andrew Johnson on. But every impeachment has taken place because of an opposite party having a majority. We're going to get another caller aboard here, and that's Renee from Alpine, California. Hi, Renee.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I have a question and comment. I'm wondering, you guys are probably familiar with the body of work of George Lakoff, the cognitive scientist.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear you guys, I hear about this dilemma of what to do with the whole White House and Trump and being called names and all of that. And a lot of people really want the press to boycott. And I hear you saying it's a dilemma because you have to report the news. But my thought, based on what Lakoff teaches, is that really we don't hear news coming out of Trump's mouth. We hear whatever it is he wants to tell his base. So he speaks. The Democrats get outraged. Some of the Republicans get reinforced. And a lot of us would love to see you guys boycott and then spend the time on what's behind the facade at the White House with your great investigative reporting. And it seems to me like that is a real option, because every time we see a press conference, we just think, you know, we just get frustrated. I don't think we're really being given news that will impact us, aside from the fact that Trump is nothing if not consistent.
Well, it's also, and thank you for the comment, and fortunately for all of us, neither Michael nor I control news organizations, so we're not going to make those decisions. But you're right in that we are suffering the shiny object school of journalism, where, you know, a day after the midterm elections, the earthquake of the midterm elections, well, the president fires his attorney general, and we're off chasing that story, and then he's off to... We have the
caravan.
Attention span of a gnat. Over the weekend, the president of the United States confuses the leaders of the Baltics with the leaders of the Balkans. This would have been weeks of convulsions in previous administrations, and it's barely a ripple.
The thing that really hit home with me on what you just said was when the New York Times reported a great investigative study of the Trump finances
Yes.
and the history of the Trump finances, and it went like a blip, like so many other things, because too many stories and too many chaotic stories
Yeah.
that really bring us into chaos to a greater extent. And it almost seems like there's a desire to perhaps sow chaos. I don't want to guess Trump's motivations anymore.
No, I think that's an explicit stated desire. He's going to blow things up. He's going to tear up the furniture. He's going to change Washington. I think there's a lot of resentment of Washington, D.C. that's behind a lot of his support.
We'll go to another caller, and let me go next to you. John, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you, Michael. Great show. Neil, I miss your voice on the radio.
Oh, well, thank you.
Glad you're back. You mentioned the disconnect between the generals and the troops. I'm always reminded of General Curtis LeMay marching into John Kennedy's office in the Cuban Missile Crisis and pushing for a preemptive strike on Russia, and Kennedy throwing him out of the office and wondering, what if Donald Trump was the president then?
Well, we, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've not had anything of that magnitude, fortunately, all that often in our history, but certainly not in the Trump administration, where the president of the United States has been put to that kind of test. And one fears that he would fall short.
Well, here's an interesting sideline on that, though. I mean, we just got news yesterday and earlier more today, and we may even cover it on forum, about missiles not being in launch position, but being in his underground places
in North Korea.
Yeah. And, you know, here was Trump.
That threat's been solved. You don't need to worry.
The whole thing has been solved. Well, not, so he loves Kim Jong-un, a mass murderer of North Koreans. But aside from that, the reality is that, again, the stories just keep jumping and hopping and going,
well,
skipping.
One of my problems with this, we did the democracy test on the theory that, you know, many of the crises we face, this country has faced before and worked its way through. And we looked at what had happened in the past and how we surpassed it before in our history. For example, the inequality of the of the robber baron era in the 1920s, how Franklin Roosevelt overcame that and reestablished a state that established the welfare state, where the government was the employer of last resort, and all kinds of Social Security and other kinds of welfare were available to various Americans. This was how that problem was solved then. Well, we're in a similar situation now. But there are other situations where we couldn't come up with historical analogies. And we look at the fires that are burning in California now as a manifestation of climate change. And there's been nothing like this in our history. I couldn't find a historical analog to climate change, which is, of course, not just a threat to our democracy, a threat to our existence. And it is something that we deal with poorly, both as a democracy and, I think, as a species, and that we respond extremely well to crisis. You know, our attention is focused, and shiny objects is an example of that. But we don't respond well to something that says, in 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to have a serious problem. We need to deal with that today and make serious sacrifices today in order to make a better world. We're still going to have problems 10, 15, 20 years from now from climate change. Make no mistake about it. But if we don't start acting now in a serious way and making economic sacrifices now, serious ones, we're going to have disaster, catastrophe on a scale that we can't imagine.
Talking again with Neil Conan. Let me try to get another caller on, and that's you. Steve, you're on.
Hello. Yes. Thanks. Great show, you guys. My question about the boycotting the news is that just one thing that you could do is stop reporting on Trump's Twitter feed. That alone would eliminate 50% of all his BS. So what do you think about that, Neil?
Well, I appreciate the spirit behind that thought. However, when the president of the United States undermines democracy by challenging the electoral processes in places like Arizona and Florida and Georgia, I think it's news. I think we have to pay attention to this. I think we have to report on it because the president of the United States is seeking to undermine the very agency that brought him to power. This is an important piece of news. I wish we could just say this is crazy, this is just, you know, nutsy talk, and we don't have to pay attention to it. I'm afraid the President of the United States, we have to pay attention to.
We're talking again with Neil Conan, and we've come to the end of this hour, which I knew would be not only a very informative and enlightening hour with Neil sharing the studio here with me, but also one where we have, well, it's just a great pleasure to hear your voice again and have you back here.
Michael, it's always a pleasure to be on with you, and I look forward to hearing your conversation with Joanne tomorrow.
Neil Conan. And by the way, the podcast is called Truth, Politics, and Power. It's distributed by American Public Media. And those of you who are fans of Neil will want to jot that down. And those of you who don't know the podcast will want to know about it as well. And the music you're hearing is Ensemble Galilee. It's from Neil Conan's show. I shouldn't say it's only Neil Conan's show. It's Neil Conan and Ann Garrett's. Again, keep that voice.
Thank you very much,
in the
Michael.
Public. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening and thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We'll be back on tomorrow if all goes according to plan. I'm Michael Krasny.